I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, your mother was on to something when she told you to stand up straight. Humans tend to use posture as a way to judge character. We'll spend this hour with cultural and literary historian Sandra L. Gilman, who will tell us about how cultures all over the world have assumed one's physical bearing could reveal something important about one's tendency toward virtue or vice. The myth has motivated a lot of odd efforts to make slouchers straighten up, but it's also had troubling implications for people with disabilities or whose bodies simply don't meet any society's ideal. Our conversation starts after a short break. Let's take a second to just consider all the expressions we use that relate to posture. We can stand tall, sit pretty, ask a friend to be straight with us, and have some backbone when we approach a challenge. It's pretty clear we attach a lot of significance to the way we carry our bodies through the world. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Sandra L. Gilman is Distinguished Professor of the Liberal Arts and Sciences and Professor of Psychiatry at Emory University. For years now, he's been fascinated by the way we use posture as a clue, accurate or not, to the moral worthiness of any given individual. When your mom told you to stand up straight, it's at least in part because we are members of a species that believes we are special because we walk upright. Gilman's book explores how that has played out over the course of human history, to the benefit of some and the detriment of others, treated with suspicion because their bodies failed to measure up. The book is called Stand Up Straight, A History of Posture. Sandra, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
We stand and we sit the way we do, of course, because of the way our individual bodies work, but also because of the way our shared culture works. Do you think most people absorb that social pressure without realizing it?
Well, I know they do. I mean, one of the things that's quite remarkable is that when you shift from culture to culture, if you go from Dallas, let us say, to Tokyo, one of the things we realize very quickly is that we have to think about the way we stand, think about the way we move, literally how we stand next to someone. But we very quickly habituate. I mean, we very quickly learn the rules, and that's certainly true of every infant who has ever moved from 4 to 2, right? From crawling to standing upright.
For one thing, we have always noted, that almost no other creatures spend as much time upright as humans do. So people have assumed there must be something blessed and special about the ability to stand up.
Or cursed and inefficient. I mean, that's the thing that's so interesting to me. I mean, we have, of course, from the Greeks on, the notion that we stand upright in order to face the gods. Or if you read Plato, maybe so that our nose gets as far away from our genitalia as possible. But then there are a huge number of people from the 16th and 17th century to today who argue that all of our problems came about because we moved from 4 to 2, from being on all fours to standing up straight. Everything from the way that our digestive system now seems not to function quite well, to the fact that we're really not suited for sitting in front of a computer, and so forth and so on. So you kind of have to figure out what people want your body to mean, and then you begin to act as if it means it.
How has posture been used to reinforce ideas about the relative merits of, say, Western cultures over those maligned as being somehow primitive because they were different?
Well, you know, I have a lot in the book about race science, this science of the 19th century. But one of the stories I tell, and I tell a lot of stories in the book, is about the Irish and how the Irish, after Cromwell invades Ireland, suddenly are seen to have a kind of endemic knock-kneed. They don't quite stand up straight like the English, because the English are upright, of course, and the Irish aren't quite upright enough. And that notion of Irish inferiority is something that we find well into the 20th century when the Irish talk about, for example, their bodies, right? They talk about it as somehow or another needing to be reformed. And that's a story that I think many people in this country who are now looking at immigrants and their bad postures seem to have forgotten.
There's also an assumption that posture is something that everybody should have control over, and this isn't true for everyone.
Well, I mean, look, we're born with bodies, and we're born with a certain developmental trajectory, right? We go from infants on our backs to crawling to standing upright, and we have musculature and we have a nervous system that in most circumstances allows us to do that within the norms of the society we live in. There are people, of course, who don't, and to be brutal about it, all of us over time, and this is, of course, the great Oedipal riddle, right? Move from four legs to two legs to three legs, from the infant to the adult to being old, and then our posture starts to become a problem again. So the answer is, of course, some people are born with postural difficulties. They're born with cerebral palsy, let us say. They're born with various forms of both neurological and orthopedic deficits. But all of us at some point get there at the end.
So it's interesting. I started reading this book thinking, well, we're over this, and we recognize now that the way that one carries one's body doesn't have anything to do with character. And yet, you know, there's the question of the people who are sitting up very straight or rocking the standing desk. We assume that they're more alert, more clued in, more concerned about their health than the slouchers in the office. And it turns out we actually have a long history of assuming a relationship between posture and productivity. This is not a 21st century invention.
Oh, not at all. The ancient Greek Xenophon believed it completely. He makes a distinction, or at least his character Socrates, right? The words put in Socrates' mouth by Xenophon. Socrates says, you know, those people who work in the fields, they're of the land and they're real citizens. But those people who work at the forges and the people who work in menial occupations, they have terrible posture. And they can't be good citizens because only good citizens have a relationship to the land. That becomes a motif in the 18th and the 19th century with the Industrial Revolution. But it's also true that working conditions can destroy your body. Mm. So it's not a one-way, in other words, it's not just that we have kind of fantasies about bodies, but we also live in worlds that reshape bodies for good or for ill.
Xenophon has Socrates say that this kind of work where you're hunched over and become maybe permanently hunched makes men's bodies womanish, which I gather was not a compliment.
No, it was not a compliment. And look, the idea of posture, even when I say the phrase stand up straight, right, is redundant of masculinity and the military. And it's very true that women's bodies are seen as being somehow or another faulty in and of themselves. But then, look, we have the rise in the 19th and early 20th century of women's colleges, Bryn Mawr, for example. And what is one of the things that is most important to them is introducing physical education for young women so that their bodies will be healthy. And now we've got this interesting parenthesis. For what? Well, it's not the military. It winds up, of course, being for childbirth. So that this eugenic model, the notion that, you know, if women only stand up straight, if women only have good posture, they'll have children who have good posture and they'll become good soldiers and good citizens or good mothers who have better children.
Posture has been used in a number of different artistic forms as a kind of shorthand clue as to how we should interpret characters. So the old Punch and Judy puppet shows, Punch had a very pronounced hump in his back.
Yeah, and his forerunners, right, in the Commedia dell'arte have this marked hunchback, right? One of the things that one has to understand is that bodies that are seen as different are seen to act as different. So you know, the Victorians loved their Punch and Judy shows. I mean, certainly, again, on the seashore in Britain, it's come back. I mean, it's part of the kind of romance of the Victorians, which was not such a great age if you didn't have a lot of money, by the way. But you see Punch, of course, beating up the policeman, beating up his wife. And the irony is, you would think, well, that's a bad lesson for little Victorian boys and girls. Well, of course, you identify with Mr. Punch. Mr. Punch can do things in society that you're not permitted to do. But the trade-off is he's got this odd body that shows him being different. And by the way, that becomes a kind of, there's a kind of romantic twist in this. I mean, think of Hunchback of Notre Dame and all the movies and from Lon Chaney on, where, of course, he becomes the great hero rescuing the beautiful woman, or attempting to rescue her, and dying with her body in the tomb. So there's this kind of notion, you know, that these bodies are extraordinary in both their negativity, but also when they're good, they're better than good.
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing, because of course Quasimodo becomes this figure that you have to admire, but he remains very servile throughout.
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, we're back to Xenophon, right? I mean, these bodies become the bodies of people on the margins. Now, the big question, of course, in the 19th century, and it really is the big question, which is, okay, you come out of a society where you are, where you slouch, where you are, you have bad posture. You come from Eastern Europe. You come from Southern Italy. You come from China. And you come into a society which is egalitarian and open and loving of strangers, although those statements meant ironically, such as the United States. The big question is your posture, or at least is the posture of your children, reformable? Hmm. Can you learn to stand up straight as an American, as a Canadian? And that becomes a real issue in the 19th century. It has to do with Jim Crow, with African Americans after slavery. It has to do with all of the immigrants at the end of the 19th, the beginning of the 20th century. And what is interesting to me, of course, is we're in the beginning of the 21st century. That ain't gone away. It's right there in every discussion about people from Latin and South America, people from the Middle East. Right? How do they carry themselves? Can they really become Americans? Can they really become Canadians?
It's strange that people didn't, maybe they realized, but they certainly didn't acknowledge the fact that one's circumstances in life can have a lot to do with posture. Of course, there's the question of your body being sort of ruined by hunching over work for decades on end. Many, you know, white people used the humble posture of enslaved black people to say, well, this is, it's clear that these individuals don't deserve full rights, when in fact the reason, you know, people of color didn't stand up straight was because they were afraid of abuse.
Yeah, yeah. But the other thing one has to say is, if you habituate the way you think you stand in the world, you habituate the way you think that other people stand in the world. If you believe, for example, that education is a tool for social mobility, that is, the hunchback Jew from Eastern Europe can become the football-playing Princeton quarterback, homage to Philip Roth, who just passed, then in point of fact, that notion of entrenched bodies being mobile and changing is fine. But if you think, hey, look, inside that so-called upright Mexican judge, or inside that Supreme Court justice who's African American, is a slouching, shuffling immigrant imprinted on his or her soul, then you see these people different intrinsically. And, you know, that's a huge problem. And it's a problem in which we imagine bodies.
I have to jump in here just a minute, please, for a break. My guest is Sander L. Gilman. We're talking about his book, Stand Up Straight, A History of Posture. We'll resume the conversation in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Sander L. Gilman, who is Distinguished Professor of the Liberal Arts and Sciences and Professor of Psychiatry at Emory University. We're discussing his book, Stand Up Straight, A History of Posture. If you want to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, email think at kera.org, or find us on Twitter. We're at KERAThink. And Sander, before the break, you were talking about the idea that some people have that there might be an intrinsically inferior posture sort of, concealed by people who have deliberately tried to stand or sit or present themselves physically in a different way.
Well, this is part of a kind of a fascination of the 18th and 19th century, which is, okay, we let people into our society or we let people into our class, and they start to dress like us and they start to talk like us. But are they really like us? And then we begin to sort of focus in on, well, maybe that's only the external. Yeah, you can train people to stand up straight, but does that make them real men or real women? And that, by the way, is a kind of set of stereotypes which we have today. Think about people slouching. Think about people who don't stand up quite the way you want them to stand up. We have bizarre laws in this country about people who wear their pants too low. I mean, you can't make that stuff up in the history of posture. You really can't. And those laws are directed against people who stand and move in ways that we think are not only inferior, but dangerous. And that's the whole point. If you can't tell them apart from us, we start to look about how we might be able to identify them.
All right, I want to talk about the Greeks, ancient Greeks and Romans. First of all, is there any reason to believe that regular people moved through the world with posture like the statuary that survives into modern times?
Well, look, anybody who confuses, and the doctors do in the 19th and 20th century, Roman and Greek sculpture and murals with real people have got real problems, right? I mean, no one would imagine looking at a Picasso painting that, my God, that maybe there are people out there with three eyes, but these statues stand the way ideal posture is imagined. The thing that is quite striking about them, if you compare the postures in many of the great statues, Praxiteles statues, for example, and you say to yourself, could people, under normal circumstances, stand like that? The answer is, of course, they can't. The spine doesn't move in that direction. But then if you say, well, what happens if you take that great medical diagnostic category of Greek medicine, right, which is called scoliosis, right, the deformity of the palm of the spine, or lordosis, the deformity of the spine. Well, then all of these people who have perfect statues in the Greek world really have a kind of pathology. And that's one of the big divisions that we have. We have this kind of fantasy about perfect bodies, but we also have an anxiety about being imperfect in ourselves.
How has military training played into the perception of ideal postures over time?
Well, you know, I said that, the stand up straight is a phrase that is, well, if not first spoken in the military, I think our mothers probably were the first to say to us, stand up straight. But we have, again, this notion of military bodies, right? The Nazi body being rigid. But that's a process that starts in the 17th century with modern military structures, such as the introduction of what becomes the rifle and the pistol. And the way then that you had to move to be efficient using these early weapons. The first handbooks, if you look at the people, they're slouching all over the place. It's only very, very gradually through the 18th and 19th and 20th century that we get this exaggerated chin-in, rigid spine of the imaginary soldier. Because the truth is, if you stood in attention on the field looking like that, and we see this regularly, what happens is you faint.
Right.
Right? Because our
knees
bodies...
locked, knee, yeah.
Yeah, it's right. Our bodies are always self-correcting. And once you stop letting the body self-correct, right, then all you wind up doing is falling on your face. That almost always happens at early drills at West Point in Annapolis.
Was there a relationship between rigid drill positions and strategic rigidity or flexibility on the battlefield?
Well, again, this is something that, again, you've got to imagine the first time people introduce guns onto the battlefield. The early guns have a certain set of problems. First of all, it takes a while to load, to aim. The aim is terrible. These are not rifled, right? The bullets go all over hell and creation. And you don't want anybody in front of you or even to the side of you. You don't want to shoot. So what they first start to do is to say, okay, you have to do it in a certain pattern. That certain pattern, they say, well, it's just like the Romans. It's nothing like the Romans, absolutely nothing like the Romans. But we constantly like to look to the past as models for what we're doing. As the weaponry gets better, and that is meaning more efficient in killing people, you start to get the notion that what happens is you've got to still have these kind of rigid formations. And my best case scenario is always the British at the Battle of New Orleans, where they're basically facing a bunch of American irregulars and pirates whose notion of what you do with people who march out in the middle of the field wearing red uniforms with a big white cross in the middle of it is you aim for the big white cross. So the answer is, yeah, there is this kind of rigidity, but there's always the tension between this notion of movement as groups, upright posture, the soldier's body, and so forth and so on, and efficiency. And efficiency in the battlefield has to do with moving quickly, being able to confront the enemy, and not moving in organized groups.
Right, and somebody recognized that the best body for military maneuvers was not necessarily the one that looked the straightest, but the one that could march the farthest and do the most before getting fatigued.
And we have then suddenly in the 19th century a real, honest-to-gosh science that asks, if you're carrying a 50-pound pack, how do you have to carry it in order to walk for 10 miles? What is the most efficient way to carry it? What is the most efficient shape of the pack? What about the rifle you're carrying? What kind of a body do you have to have? And that notion of a kind of precise military scientific idea of standing up straight becomes translated very quickly. It's amazing, really, in the same generation to people working at Ford who are assembling, right? Think of the people on the Ford assembly line as a bunch of soldiers, right, marching through the field who are assembling, and they have to be efficient in their assemblage. They have to move their bodies in certain ways. They have to lift certain things in certain ways. And suddenly, again, we started with this question about standing up straight and standing at the desk and being efficient in your work. Suddenly, military qualities gets ascribed to what? The worker's body standing up straight.
How did we get the word straight as an antonym for gay?
Well, I mean, the answer is that very, very, very early on, I mean, very early on with the Romans, there is a juxtaposition, Juvenal makes it, between the healthy body and the healthy mind, right? Which is then becomes a kind of litmus test for talking about this from Juvenal up through the 20th century. You must have a healthy body and a healthy mind. But that's juxtaposed by Juvenal against those people who spend their days luxuriating on silk-covered couches, basically having people peel grapes for them, the effeminate male body. This notion of gay and straight, those words are not random. The straight in gay and straight is not a random word. It has to do with this juxtaposition between feminized gay bodies and this notion of a kind of rigid body that is both healthy, of course, in mind and morals as well as in body.
And then you had, we're jumping all around in history here, and I know
it's good.
That.
It's good.
How did Immanuel Kant push back against the popular assumption that human reason and intelligence were a consequence of our development of upright posture?
Well, you know, again, if you start to look at the early church, and they get this from the Greeks, right? Again, look at the Old Testament. There's not a word in the creation story about Adam, never mind about Eve, about Adam standing up straight. It's just not part of the narrative. The Greeks believe that the gods created man to stand up, to, in a sense, have a face. Literally, they say that's how you get a face, and that face then faces the gods. It means that you were created with a kind of moral quality built in. In the 18th century, a theologian by the name of Herder espouses this. And Herder, by the way, is a liberal. We have to be careful about this. This is not politically right versus politically left, but he's a Christian liberal. And what he says is that the first thing that defines human beings is upright posture, as opposed to the posture, let us say, of the great apes. And he says, we're created, again, by our creator to stand up straight, to worship God. His biggest critic is Immanuel Kant. Now, one has to say Immanuel Kant is round-shouldered. So maybe the personal plays a role in this. But what Kant says, he says, no, Herder, you're wrong. We're imperfect. We are created as what? And this is this famous phrase of Kant's, as crooked wood, out of which even the best carpenter may not be able to make anything useful. And he spends his whole career thinking about the fact that what we really have to do as human beings is not to be satisfied having created by God as something perfect in the world, but someone, a human being who is always striving for self-improvement. And by the way, that's the definition of the Enlightenment, and that's where our world comes from. Our world, whether you're talking about it in the gym, trying to get, you know, perfect abs, whether you're talking about it in terms of moral perfection, that is the notion that we always strive to do the good, never completely succeeding, but always striving, that starts with Kant and the notion that we are crooked wood.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It's interesting that we have held on to the little literal interpretation of that. It seems like humans have always understood that that's really a metaphor, and yet we continue to sort of imagine that we can fix ourselves morally and come across as better people if we work on the appearance of our bodies.
That's true. That's the root, for example, of modern aesthetic cosmetic surgery in the 19th century. The idea was that we could have control over our bodies and become individuals who could improve our bodies. And, by the way, the early surgeons said, then therefore also getting rid of all of the anxieties we have about the way we look in the world, whether or not we're round-shouldered or whether we have a Jewish nose or whether we have Irish ears. So that plays into a whole idea of the Enlightenment, some of which we might think is very positive. The notion, for example, we can go to university even though our parents never went to school, and we can become educated and we can, in a sense, improve our moral status and economic status and social status. Some of it may be a little bit more questionable. The notion, for example, that if we perfect our bodies, that our bodies are perfectible, and therefore out of that perfection we will be happier in the world, being both overweight and flat-footed, I view that as something maybe ideal but not something realizable, that might have not always positive outcomes.
We've always found ways to justify this, too. You write about the fact that beyond thinking about a relationship between posture and character, lots of people used to believe bad posture made one susceptible to infectious disease, like tuberculosis.
Absolutely. And that notion that you had a kind of tubercular body, a tubercular posture that might be able to be remedied, right? You could learn to stand up straight. That's something which you would think, okay, but tuberculosis is an infectious disease. What happens after Robert Koch discovers that it's a tubercular disease, that it's an infectious disease? Well, that notion of the tubercular body continues well into the 20th century, 40, 50, 60 years after Koch discovers that you get tuberculosis like you get a cold, not because you're standing in a window or that you are slouching, but because, in point of fact, you've been exposed to an infectious disease. So that idea somehow or another that our bodies are reformable and therefore we will be healthy, maybe live forever, right? That's the big promise. We say, eat your broccoli, stand up straight, you will live forever. And that's part maybe of the fantasy that we have that kind of control, because we don't have always control about the bacteria and viruses we come in contact with. Or perhaps we never have any control about the bacteria and viruses we come in contact with, except maybe through vaccination.
My guest is Sander L. Gilman, Distinguished Professor of the Liberal Arts and Sciences and Professor of Psychiatry at Emory University. We're talking about his new book, Stand Up Straight, A History of Posture. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Emory University Distinguished Professor of the Liberal Arts and Science and Professor of Psychiatry, Sander L. Gilman. His book is called Stand Up Straight, A History of Posture. Join us by calling 800-933-5372 or going to Twitter at @KERAThink. Sander, what has been the effect for people with physical disabilities of our obsession with posture?
Well, to start with, of course, once you start getting idealized bodies, bodies that deviate from those ideals, wind up being labeled in all sorts of ways. They be not only that they are incomplete or that they are impossible or that they are ugly, but it also immediately talks about the fact that they therefore can't be efficient, they can't work, they can't think straight. And there's this odd relationship between non-normative bodies, right, and notions of not being able to fit into a society. And of course, we for a very long time, I would even argue even today, have created a physical world where people who have non-normative bodies find it very difficult. People with a wheelchair find it difficult to enter buildings where you have to walk up flights of stairs. And so that notion that the disabled, which is the term that we use rather than non-normative, some or another also have something, can we say, morally, economically, socially incomplete about themselves. And as a result, we close them out from most of where society expects quote-unquote normal people to function.
All right, let's go to the phones. We have Jessica on the line in Plano. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
FDR suffered from the effects of polio, and so being speaking engagements, especially in public, he made it a point to wear really heavy braces to stand up. But towards the end of his presidency, he sat down, especially the last address he made in Congress. And I was wondering what impact that has on public perception of him.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I actually deal a good deal with the image of FDR, because FDR's image when he's alive is that of someone who does not have a disability. It's quite fascinating. That is, we know of only two photographs of FDR in a wheelchair. And they've never, not photographs that were circulated during his own lifetime. Everybody was part of a global conspiracy not to talk about the fact that FDR could not stand without heavy braces. And indeed, toward the end of his life, as he became less and less well with heart disease, he found it difficult to use those heavy braces. So indeed, he sat down. It's only in the 1980s and 90s, and we know this because the FDR Memorial is put up in D.C. without FDR in a wheelchair at all, without any mention of the fact that he spent most of his life, certainly most of his adult life, non-normative, right? But there is this shift in American culture. And then under Bill Clinton, there is this wheelchair sculpture added. This caused and was caused by a kind of rethinking about these non-normative bodies. The Americans with Disability Act comes about, changes in the World Health Organization, notions of what a disability is comes about. And it's absolutely this image of FDR, which during his lifetime is of one who is, can we use the word, robust and healthy, to someone who is non-normative, is something that has happened certainly in the lifetime of most people who are alive after the beginning of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is 50 years old this year.
I've been really interested to follow the push to amend the icon used to depict a person using a wheelchair on restrooms and in public spaces to emphasize the action of a chair user moving through the world. Posture really means a lot here in this very simple sort of line drawing that people are familiar with. As one activist said, disabled people are not confined to wheelchairs. They are liberated by them.
Well, I mean, this notion of what icon do you use to represent non-normative ability, right? Disability is important to me. The wheelchair icon begins in the 1970s. In other words, it begins as we begin to talk about disability in a different way. Before that, it was the three-dot bandana you wore on your arm, which signified either being blind or deaf, which were the touchstone disabilities up through the 20th century. The wheelchair gets introduced, first of all, in the Montreal Olympics. It gets introduced then officially, absolutely, as a kind of icon, not only of postural disability, disability of mobility, but of all disabilities, of all disabilities. And then about 15 years ago, a young Irish graduate student decided that, you're right, it looked passive, so he does it at an angle. Now, most of the ones we see are this World Health Organization accepted icon of a stylized person in a wheelchair. Though I was just in Toronto, and throughout Toronto there is this icon of wheelchair mobility that is now reappearing officially, right? But very few people think of this as a postural icon, an icon that has to do with the way we stand, sit, and move through the world. They think of it simply as an icon of what? Disability and disability access. Think about any parking space that has that sign on it. We don't think of that in any way that has to do with our posture. It has to do with their posture.
How have women and men been subjected to different rules about posture?
Well, I think that's certainly generally true, because women and men have been slotted since the Greeks into two kind of roles. And those roles have weird spin-offs. In the 1980s, a very leading anthropologist decided, because we have these theories, why do we stand up straight? Why do we suddenly become bipedal? And he has a theory that, that started, of course, when the men went out to have to bring food back to the women in the cave, right? So the men had to stand up straight because they had to carry the food back, right? You carry more in your arms than you do in your teeth. This was the first generation of feminist science studies, and they looked at this paper, which had lots of resonance, by the way. People said, oh, that sounds reasonable, and said, wait a minute. You mean women didn't stand up straight at all? Well, that echoes this distinction that goes indeed back to the Greeks about women being basically reproductive organisms, while men, in point of fact, are active supply organisms in the world. And both of those are defined by different standards of posture and different postural training. 18th and 19th century young men are trained to stand up like little soldiers, 4 and 5 year olds, right? And young women are trained to sit and learn to knit and learn to do housework. So this is a built-in set of Western stereotypes, and they redound even in sports. I mean, when we start to think about women's sports and men's sports, I mean, today we start to realize, wait a minute, those aren't really good categories, right? But they were very much to the beginning of the 20th century. Who could play basketball? Who could play football? Who played field hockey? I mean, field hockey for me is the great joke in North America because it's been played by young girls at women's colleges. And of course, in South Asia, it's one of the most vicious men's sports, right? How do you stand up? What do you play?
I wasn't fully aware of the debate over the use of corsets until I read your book. Lots of people agreed that they were necessary, but the question over whether corseting strengthened or weakened the wearer in the long run was like really, really fierce.
It was fierce, but also, you know, it's a weird thing because we use the word corset, okay? What do you imagine under corset? Do you imagine someone who has a medical corset because they have bad posture, they have scoliosis? Or do you imagine someone who is trying to have a less of a waist, right? And therefore has a what we can call a fashion corset. Well, there's this big debate, both in terms of whether the corset actually helps or hinders the body, but whether it is therapy or whether it is vanity. And that becomes part and parcel of a big discussion that splits. We are shocked by this along gender lines. By the way, men wore corsets for both purposes, and women wore corsets for both purposes. But this is a really interesting debate that if you follow it from the standpoint of women in corsets tend to be vanity and the destruction of the rib cage and everything else. And if you start to think about it in terms of men in corsets, it winds up being medical doctors and corseting to create better, healthier bodies.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Back to the phones now. Jim is on the line in Hearst. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I had a question about celebrities and their posture. When I think of posture, I think of two particular people. One is Jennifer Garner, who I think has an absolutely wonderful, statuesque, perfect posture. I'm sure the designers love to dress her because she looks so beautiful in clothes. She just has perfect posture. And the other one is Peter Falk, who, as Columbo, was incredibly intelligent but terrible posture. What's the public perception of that kind of thing?
Thanks for your call.
Well, I mean, the Peter Falk character is a lovely one because he had bad posture, because he slumped, right, in his dirty raincoat, because he looked like somebody who was a non-entity, people always underestimated. And this is one of those stereotypes. Bad posture, good character, bad posture, bad character. We play with that all the time. with Jennifer Garner, it's a really interesting question about women's posture, because what has happened again since the late 20th century is the athleticization of the female body. If you look, and it's quite fascinating to do, if you look at the icons of female postural beauty in the mid-20th century, you get people who today would not be viewed as rather attractive in terms of their posture. Marilyn Monroe, Jane Mansfield. And then you start to think, well, what about the late 20th century, the 21st century? All of a sudden, what you do is you start to get this, and I'm going to use this word in quotation marks, masculinized posture. The young woman who stands up straight. And that strikes me as a rather interesting shift. We've seen it before. It's not the first time that it appears. But this shift from a clearly feminized body as an ideal, right? We're back to Greek sculptures. These are idealized bodies. They're not the way most people look. Most people walk in the world, sit in the world. Same thing with questions of masculinity, you know? Peter Falk is not Sean Connery, right? 007 walks, of course, with a kind of masculine swagger as opposed to Peter Falk's slump.
What's so interesting, and we're about out of time here, but one could argue that Sean Connery is also not 007. That's a character. He doesn't move through the world that way all the time.
Of course. And that's, of course, the point with Greek sculpture,
yeah,
is that Peter Falk may have stood up straight and done, you know, his body may have been beautiful and he may have trained at the gym. I do not know. But it's the character that he inhabits. It's the character that Jennifer Garner inhabits. It's the character that Sean Connery inhabits. It's exactly the way that someone like Hogarth looks at Praxiteles' great sculptures and says, this is the ideal perfect body.
Sander L. Gilman is Distinguished Professor of the Liberal Arts and Sciences and Professor of Psychiatry at Emory University. His new book is called Stand Up Straight, A History of Posture. Sander, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for making time
for us. It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Twitter at KERA Think, and you can find the podcast using any podcast app or go to the website think.kera.org, where you'll find bios and archives of the show as well. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.